This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Everyone, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 7, Part 2 of Resolved Mysteries.
Hi!
Welcome on back.
You came on back, even though we scared the absolute shit out of you last episode.
I mean, I didn't know if I was going to come back. I was on the fence. I was a little too scared.
I know you were scared.
Everyone's so brave, and I'm so proud of everyone.
Thank you.
So, if you're new here, this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. And I'm Eliza.
I'm Allison.
And I am Carlin.
And welcome. As most of you know, but just a little reminder, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization, and this month's is the Epilepsy Foundation, and thank you to our patron Ruth for suggesting it.
Well, we just need to stop for just a minute to say we are in a Portland heat wave right now.
Yes. And it's impossible.
And the thing is, when you record a podcast, you can't have background noises, so everyone's AC is off. Mm-hmm. And according to my off AC, it says, I think it's like over 80 degrees in this room.
So. Yeah. And it warms up so fast. It's like 108 degrees outside right now.
We're getting a little delirious.
And I'm trying to make a friendship bracelet. My fingies are just sweating, so it's difficult for me right now.
I've been fidget spinning, and my fingies aren't sweaty yet, but it's danger. There's danger there.
There's danger. There's a danger of fingy sweat.
I could lose a tooth.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's weird that would be your first concern.
It's heavy.
Then be careful.
Yeah, don't do that. Listen, I know that you don't want to lose a tooth. I can fully, fully tell you.
Guys, don't make me put on a helmet, okay?
Okay, so that's where we're at. That's what you're getting today, friends. And that should explain every mistake that we make, okay?
Give us some grace.
So what might make us feel better in our heat wave, what might send a little chills down our spine in a good way is if people sign up for Patreon.
Yeah. That. Natural born saleswoman is what I always say.
Oh, always. I always have been. You will get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, and early access to listener short stacks and perhaps some goodies in the mail if you sign up. So go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast. Also, we have an option for patrons to pay for the entire year if you're rich. Instead of monthly, but then if you do that, you will save 10% on the full year, which is a smoking deal.
I don't think that rich is a qualifier because it's
only $5 a month.
It's $5.
And, you know, you got it.
You also get a discount for doing it. So you don't have to be rich.
You get a discount for being rich.
I love a discount. I clip coupons. I'm like an old lady.
I love. Okay, so for the brave that returned to us, what do we have? This is less of a spook episode, but what are we covering?
Well, we have a missing persons segment about Marianne Perez.
And then we got a fraudy, Dr. John Anderson.
Oh, okay, here we go.
Okay. This is the missing persons segment of Marianne Perez. Hmm. March 25th, 19... I know, you're shaking your head already, and I haven't even talked about it yet. March 25th, 1976, Marianne Perez of Chalmette, Louisiana, said goodbye to her teenage daughter, Donna. Donna was going to babysit her younger siblings so that Marianne could go out with a girlfriend. Sharon Perez Miller, one of the daughters, says that Marianne had told Donna she'd call to check in at about 10 or 11 p.m. Quote, and Donna said she got a phone call from Mama first. She says their mom had said that she was okay and she'd be home shortly. Then, at 1:30 a.m., Donna said she got a phone call from a woman named Dorothy. So this is the reenactment of the call. Mm-hmm. Quote, "Hi, my name's Dorothy, and I'm a friend of your mama's. I'm calling to let you know she's having car trouble, so she'll be a little late getting home tonight." Mm. Donna asks if she's okay. And, like, Donna's asleep. She wakes up to this call, so she's, like, groggy, and she's like, "Is she okay?" And the woman's like, "She'll be fine. She'll be home soon. Bye." Mm. And that's it.
Hate it.
So then we have a interview with Wayne Thomas, which is Marianne's brother, and he says he didn't know the name Dorothy. And he also knew there was something wrong somewhere because the car was basically brand new and there wasn't any reason for car trouble. Mm. So as we can guess without knowing the rest of the segment, Marianne never called and never returned home. Mm. Marianne's family would eventually come to learn that she'd gone to meet her friend at a country western bar on the outskirts of New Orleans. The next morning, Marianne's car was found parked right in front of the club in the parking lot. There was no evidence of car trouble in the vehicle, and it was running perfectly. 3 days later, Marianne's purse was found at the bottom of Lake Pontchartrain, 10 miles away, weighted down by a brick.
Hmm. We're both just like, very, this is like the very, only sound that we're making.
Yeah.
We can't. Yeah. We can't make any other sound for this segment. No, we're just like,
too terrible.
And there was no trace of Marianne anywhere. 9 years passed with Marianne still missing. Gosh. Then in 1985, the New Orleans Police Department sent a detective to Wichita, Kansas to question a man named David Courtney. Stack says that Courtney and his wife confessed to a multi-state killing spree, and one of their victims seems to have a lot in common with Marianne Perez.
There is something so terrifying about a husband and wife duo. I remember our car broke down on the turnpike when I was a little girl, and it was a million degrees. It was just like today, and my mom's shitty beater overheated, and we were stuck on the side of the road, and we didn't know if we should walk to a payphone, and this car pulled up, and it was a couple, and we got in, because my mom later was like, well, I assumed that there was a woman in the car, so it would be okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you find out, like, all of these crazy horror stories, and it's just, there's something really, as a woman, there's something really terrifying.
It's really sinister.
I would 100%, if I wasn't a listener of true crime podcasts, would get in that car if I saw that there was a woman in there.
Yeah, you know, and you know my mother. She's very savvy, but it was desperation. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with this, like, a five-year-old on the side of the turnpike? People are blazing past you. It's 100 degrees, you know? Yeah.
So, just as a side note, the entire segment, they do not say the name of Courtney's wife.
Yeah.
They just say his wife the whole time, which I thought was so bizarre.
Yeah.
And it turns out her name was Donna. So, I don't know if they left that out because the daughter's name was also Donna.
Oh, okay.
And they just felt that it would be confusing. But that, I feel, is a very weird choice because she is very much involved in these crimes.
Whoa. Like, oh, man.
Okay, so then we have an interview with Detective Bob Lambert, and he says that when he went to Kansas to interview Courtney, he told him about a female he had abducted in New Orleans. He said he'd been driving the highway when he pulled into the parking lot of a country western bar. Mm. In the reenactment, he pulls into the parking lot, and the woman is sort of stumbling out of the bar and kind of stumbles right into the car. And he's like, "Whoa, are you okay?" And she's like, yeah, I am, thank you. And he says, "You're not driving that car, are you?" And she says, I've got to get home to my kids. Mm. Which also, no, honey, please don't drive home drunk to your kids. Not also not a good move.
I know.
Anyway, Courtney says, well, why don't you let my wife and I take you home? He says, she's right up the road. I'm about to pick her up. And she's like, no. I live all the way in Chalmette. That's too far. And he's like, oh, that's no problem. We live in Chalmette. It's on the way there. So she's like, if you really don't mind, and he's like, of course, no problem. I'd feel really bad leaving you here in the shape you're in. So she says she probably should and gets in the car. Like, she's being like, you're right. Driving home drunk is dumb. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get in this car. So then they bop back to the reenactment of the interrogation with Courtney. And he says they did go pick up his wife after that, and they took her straight back to our trailer. Mm-hmm. Bob Lambert says he stated that this female fell asleep on the chair in the trailer and there was some sexual advancements made by Courtney's wife, Donna, which woke up this female, and she became disturbed and irate and upset about what was going on, and they agreed to give her a ride home at that time.
Ugh.
Which we already...
That's a lie.
Are like, you're lying about many things, probably.
100%.
Courtney said his wife drove the car, and he sat in the back seat with the woman as they took, quote, their intended victim home. Stack says that, quote, Courtney said he had already killed once, and he and his wife were afraid this woman would go to the police if they let her live.
Jesus.
So in the reenactment, he's like, it's fine. We're just taking you home, and it's all over. It's all like, sorry about what happened. It's
our
fine.
Bad.
Ugh. Yeah. And he's like, that's your street right there. Can't you see it? Can't you see it? And she's like, I don't recognize this place. That's not the way to my house. This is not the way home. This is not the way home. And then the fucking scariest reenactment we've seen.
Yeah.
He just turns around, and they don't show it, obviously, because they go into shadow a little bit. But he starts strangling her.
Mm-hmm.
And they put in sound effects of her being strangled.
I know. It's
which
pretty...
is kind of next level for UM.
Yeah, it is.
So that was really horrifying.
Yes.
Courtney said that he and his wife dumped the victim near the Louisiana-Mississippi state line. He says they didn't try to hide the body. They just pulled her out and dumped her.
Mm.
Stack says that the police became more and more certain that this victim had been Marianne Perez. Mm. So the whole time they're like, we don't know what this woman's name was.
Yeah.
Like, we just abducted her, you know.
Oh, I didn't care.
Imagine.
So back to the reenactment of the interrogation. The detective shows Courtney a photo of Marianne and asks if he can identify her. And very casually, Courtney says, could be. Yeah, that kind of looks like her. A little bit heavy, but I can't be 100% sure. Yeah, I think so. Maybe.
Oh, I hate him. Such a good actor, but I hate him.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
He's amazing because I hate him. I hate him so much.
Yep. But then he shows them a photo of Marianne's car and asks if he recognizes anything in the photo. And he goes, oh, that's her car, definitely.
Wow.
Like, he's like, it was green. Like, I remember.
Jesus.
So Detective Lambert then spoke to Courtney's wife and asked her about Marianne's purse. Because, like, you know, the woman would know about the purse. It, like, the way they broke down this interrogation is stupid. So he asks her if the woman they abducted had a purse, and she says yes, and that she had thrown it over a bridge they were crossing at the time.
Mm.
So it's all matching up to what they have found.
Mm-hmm.
So back to Shannon, one of Marianne's daughters. She says, quote, my daddy came into the room, and he got us all together, and he said to us, he said, Mama is dead.
Mm.
He said, they found the people that did it, and she's dead. She's gone. Gosh. And it tore us up because we had a lot of hope until that.
Mm. Oh, my gosh.
So based on the statement from Courtney, an extensive search was conducted. Marianne's body was not found, quote, even though all his other victims were found where he said they would be.
Mm. I mean, that is interesting.
Yes. Well, and you're like, how many fucking victims are there? What is happening?
Yeah. Well, I just assumed when he said that they had killed once before and they were worried that she was going to go to the police, that this absolutely was not a one-off.
Yeah. So, Stack tells us that Courtney's were never charged with Marianne's murder.
Mm.
So the hope that maybe she was alive was still there.
Mm.
In 1990, Marianne's case was brought to light again. 15 years after Marianne's disappearance, the wife of her oldest son, Elward, received a phone call from a woman who claimed to be Marianne's best friend. Shawn Perez, Elward's wife, who looks about 18 years old, says the woman asked to speak to Elward, but he wasn't home, and she didn't want to tell the stranger he wasn't home. Smart girl.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So she says, if the woman won't tell her who she is, she won't let her speak to Elward.
Mm.
And the woman says, it's about Marianne. And this little southern sweetie says, what about Miss Marianne?
I know.
And she says, Miss Marianne is still alive. So reenactment of the call. Quote, I'm calling for Marianne because they won't let her call. Marianne can't remember. Look, do you have Donna's number? So the daughter-in-law says she doesn't have the number. The caller, according to Stack, was emphatic and said she wouldn't be able to call again because Marianne wasn't allowed. Quote, I'm telling you, Marianne is still alive. I don't understand why you don't want to help her. And then she hangs up the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
So Wayne Thomas, Marianne's brother, says that made him feel more positive that maybe Marianne was alive.
No.
He says people have said it might be a prank call, and he's not sure, but he knows that if she is alive, he wants to find her. He says the whole family would like to have her come home. Mm. So Stack tells us that authorities think that it's nearly impossible that Marianne could be alive, but he says Marianne's family holds on to the chance that David Courtney, who swore he was drunk at the time, maybe didn't succeed in strangling her.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, so Shannon says he murdered several other people and their bodies were found, so that gives us some hope that maybe he might have strangled her unconscious, thinking she was dead, and threw her out. Marianne's brother Wayne says maybe she had amnesia or something like it. And maybe some of the brain cells were destroyed and she can't remember who she is or what she was and coming to sometime after the Courtneys left and just wandered out.
That made me so sad.
So Shannon speculates maybe she got up several hours later. Maybe there's a slight possibility that she is somewhere out there. Stack asks, did Marianne Perez miraculously survive, the victim of amnesia, or did David Courtney kill her? And this is asked over a mugshot of Courtney, who looks very scary.
Yes.
And Stack says Courtney is currently serving a life sentence for the confessed murder of one of his other victims. Wayne says he flip-flops between thinking Courtney did murder Marianne and thinking he doesn't know what happened to her. But he says she's gone and has been gone for 15 years, and he doesn't know if she's dead or alive. Mm. Shannon says we love her, we miss her, and we want her back. That's all we want. And if she's gone, we still want a gravesite to put flowers on. Mm-hmm. Stack tells us that as of the airing of that segment, the family has been waiting 15 years to learn what happened to Marianne, and they're hoping that Sean Perez will call again. He says Marianne's family wants the caller to know they are eager to cooperate. Quote, each one of them holds on to the hope, no matter how illusory, that one day Marianne will come home. And then Stack does like a physical description of Marianne. And they show an age progression photo of what she might look like at 48. But then there's no update.
Yeah. Wow. That was disappointing for sure.
That always is.
Made my heart sink. Okay, so let's talk about David and Donna Courtney.
Ugh. Do we have to? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I know. Like you just said, serial killing couples are a special breed of evil. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this a couple times before. Mm-hmm. But I think this is our first serial killer couple on UM.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
And while the segment is about Marianne, how can we not want to know a little bit of the history of this
dick-bitch
duo?
Absolutely.
So the details available out there are surprisingly minimal for, like, how surprised I was that this was a serial killing couple segment. Mm-hmm. But I do have info on the arrest of the Courtneys. So they really just kind of breezed by it in UM. But remember, they were already in prison when David had questioned Courtney about the killing that could potentially be Marianne. So in 1979... 5 days before Christmas, the body of 20-year-old Tamara Lynn Taylor of Wichita was found frozen with a rope around her neck in a ditch 2 miles into Harvey County.
Gosh. Jesus.
4 months went by with no answers as to who had killed Tamara Lynn. But in April of 1980, just before dawn, two police officers ran a license tag check on a van they saw. Like, I think that's the thing police do. They just will periodically scan a plate and be like, what's up with this?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're stopped at a stoplight and they're behind you.
Mm-hmm. Like, they're just sitting there, so they're going to run your plates. Mm-hmm. So they do this, and it turned out the tag was registered to a different vehicle than it was attached to. The officers followed the van to a driveway in Wichita. The police stopped the driver, who turned out to be David Courtney. Courtney gave them permission to search the van. Inside the van, the officers found a box of .38 caliber bullets, and Courtney was wearing a .38 caliber Colt in a shoulder holster under his coat. Also inside the van were two letters. One was in a sealed envelope that had been addressed to the district attorney.
Weird.
The letter, written by Courtney, obviously, said that he hoped to be dead by the time it was read.
Wow.
Courtney told the officers he was planning to, quote, blow his head off.
Yeah. Yeesh.
The letter also detailed Tamara Taylor's kidnapping and killing. Wow. And it also gave details of a robbery Courtney had committed in Phoenix, two more people he had killed in Houston.
Oh, my God.
Which were, it took me a while to find, but it was a gas station attendant that they robbed and then killed, and a, quote, vagrant, see, houseless person, that they had also killed.
Whoa.
And a New Orleans kidnapping and strangulation, which, as we know, points to Marianne Perez.
Wow.
Huh. So since obviously the police were there with Courtney, who is very much alive, he also just told them firsthand his account of Taylor's murder.
Wow.
So the couple, Dick Bitch and Dick Bitch, what are their names? Donna and, what is his name? David. David and Donna.
D&D.
The couple had only moved to Wichita a year earlier, and they were, quote, drifters, which I think means they just drove around being disgusting together.
Oh, yeah.
All over the South.
Oh, yeah.
So this was a gross piece of info I found from one article. David Courtney said his wife was fascinated with the idea of murder.
No.
Quote, he said she asked him what it would be like to kill someone, according to statements from Wichita police. Yeah, so to me, it sounds like they would literally, like, that was their pastime, was just driving around looking for victims.
Oh, my God.
So Tamara Taylor had been hitchhiking and headed to visit her boyfriend in El Dorado. The couple picked Taylor up and brought her to their mobile home, where for 3 days she was handcuffed to a bed.
Oh, my God.
Quote, so that Mrs. Courtney could have sex with her.
Oh, my God.
So that just made me think Marianne was brought to their mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
But this is 3 years later, and this time they're using handcuffs. So it's like they're getting more professional at it.
Wow.
The Courtneys then drove Taylor to Oklahoma, where they had planned to kill her. So they would, like, do this. They would drive state to state to, like, kill someone and dump the body.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, they ended up coming back to Kansas. We don't know why that decision was made. But as they were driving, David strangled Taylor with a rope while Donna drove the van, just like David strangled Marianne with a hanger while Donna drove the van. So they are very much, like, doing this the same way. After this, David Courtney was obviously arrested, and Donna Courtney would be arrested later that morning at a friend's house. The original arrest was based on them knowing about the Tamara Taylor murder. Like, obviously, there were many confessions in this letter.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tamara Taylor one, they were getting that firsthand confession. And
yeah.
So that's how they get arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start putting together the pieces and realizing that they are the prime suspects for Marianne's case as well.
Oof.
So 2 days after the arrest, David Courtney slits his wrist with a razor while he was in the Sedgwick County Jail.
Whoa.
The sheriff's office stated that a convicted arsonist saved his life by tearing up a towel and making a tourniquet.
Whoa.
So one of the other prisoners was like, nope. So by July 1980, Courtney had pled guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison. Donna pled guilty to aiding and abetting first-degree murder and was sentenced to life. So that's where the UM story picks up, is like them interrogating Courtney while he's in jail. And Lambert has all these, gets all these details from Courtney about the New Orleans killing, which ends up him being like, this is fucking Marianne.
Yeah.
So in my episode notes, I literally typed a sad face after I wrote, there's no updates, because usually that means there's no updates.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what, honeys? Okay. We do have an update.
Yay!
And it came in 2018, which is why it was not inserted in UM.
Okay.
So we know that part of why the authorities couldn't even begin a criminal case against the Courtneys for Marianne was because even though they'd confessed to a murder, they had no body. They had no evidence. They basically had nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Courtneys had told authorities where all the other bodies of their victims were, and they had found everyone except Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the last few years, Mobile County Sheriff's Office Detective J.T. Thornton began to look into local cold cases. Quote, I actually went to investigate another Jane Doe that was found in 76, Thornton said. And behind her, I found Jane Doe X2. So I thought there might be some correlation, so I started investigating and found there was no correlation. But while he's working on this, Thornton meets another detective in Harrison County, Mississippi, who remembered Perez's case. So he's like, telling him about it. And so this prompts Thornton to go to New Orleans and talk to Perez's family.
Wow.
So from the family, he learns that Marianne had been in a car accident shortly before her disappearance, and due to this, she also had a partial dental plate.
Okay,
yes. So these are things we can identify.
Mm-hmm.
So Thornton was able to match these details to the Jane Doe that had some things in common.
Wow.
Evidence of a car accident, partial dental plate, her physical description matched Marianne, The clothes and jewelry she was wearing matched the description of what Marianne was wearing when she disappeared.
Wow.
So he's like, oh my God. So he goes to check, but the Jane Doe body wasn't there anymore. And like nobody could tell where it was.
Oh no.
So it took a while. And then by a chance encounter with another cold case investigator, Thornton finally had a break. Quote, the state attorney general's office sent an investigator down there who also works cold cases, Thornton said. So when he comes in, he's like, do you know anything about this cold case? And he said, I do. I've been hunting for the remains. And he says, we've been looking for the case that goes with the remains.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So this is just a total, like, chance encounter.
Get your chocolate out of my peanut butter.
Oh, my God. Aww. I imagine them, like, hugging and jumping up and down.
Yeah. So cute.
So the body of this Jane Doe had been found in an Alabama town just over the Mississippi state line. And just because the authorities in this area did not know about Marianne's disappearance in New Orleans, the two were never connected.
Crazy.
And then the bones were sent to Oklahoma because they had been shipped there for facial reconstruction in 77. It was like a specific place that needed to go for facial reconstruction.
Whoa.
So it took a while, but we got the bones, we got the person, we got the case. It's all coming together. And so Marianne had gone missing in Louisiana, and the Courtneys had only said that they dumped the body either at the Louisiana-Mississippi border or the Mississippi-Alabama border.
Jesus.
So they didn't really know where they dropped it. Authorities didn't know where they dropped it. Back then, police departments did not talk to each other, as we've talked about a million times. So once Thornton finally found the Jane Doe's body in Oklahoma and linked all this info from Marianne's case, then they asked Marianne's daughter, Donna, to submit DNA because the remains were all they had to go by. Mm-hmm. So she submits a DNA sample, and then in 2018, the DNA test positively identified the remains to be Marianne.
Wow.
The teamwork.
What a saga. Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's wild.
Wow.
And that was just in 2018, and there are no articles following that. So I believe this is all still being worked on.
Okay.
So I just have a couple updates to the Courtneys.
Okay.
Donna, as we know, was sentenced to life, but then the law which she was sentenced under changed, so she became eligible for parole 2 years after because of good behavior, which is, like, not okay.
No, that is and there not was, like, good.
It was, like, in the headlines because people were like, no, this is not okay.
No.
But thankfully, she ended up not being released until 1988, which is still too soon.
No, yeah, she's a predator.
Yep. And then she wasn't off parole until 98. So way not enough time for that. Mm-mm. But she reportedly died about 20 years ago.
Goodbye.
Yep, goodbye. As of the 2018 article, it said David Courtney has been serving his life sentence since 1980 at the Lansing Correctional Facility. At the time of the article in 2018, he was 74 and in a work program. So he'd now be about 78, and his earliest possible release date is May 1st, 2022.
Too soon.
Next year. So that's disgusting, because even if he's really old and can't murder anymore,
he
deserves to die in prison. So I hope that he does, and I hope he gets another criminal charge for the murder of Marianne.
Because
there's a body now.
Right, now there's a body, and there's probably a DNA match.
She confessed.
I mean, he's got the story. He told the story, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Wow. Nice work.
I love
a late update.
Oh, my gosh.
They're my
favorite. I can't believe these gross people.
I know.
It's so disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Special place in hell for people like that.
Ugh. Good job.
Okay, everyone, the last segment of this very, very hot and sweaty episode is a fraud segment, and it's about Dr. John Anderson.
Doctor.
Stack says, Cincinnati, Ohio, November 1986. A smooth-talking con artist lays the intricate work for his latest scam. The target is Mike Wells, a coin dealer. Like most of us, Mike believes that he would never fall prey to a con man.
No one ever would.
No.
Mike Wills is interviewed, and he says that the man came across as polite and articulate. He had no reason to doubt him when he said he was a doctor. The con man, who went by the name Dr. John Anderson, asked Wills to speak to his physician's investment group at the children's hospital where he worked. Stack says the trap was now in place. 2 days later, Dr. Anderson ordered $30,000 worth of gold coins. Mike Wills agreed to bring the coins to the hospital when he addressed Anderson's investment group. So I had the pleasure of watching a short-lived Canadian series called Imposters.
Okay.
It was a show about scam artists and con men. And they had an episode about the lovely Dr. Anderson. So, spoiler alert, now it might be obvious that this scam in Cincinnati wasn't his first rodeo.
Okay.
So we're going to come to find out a lot about Dr. Anderson.
Okay.
So in this series, which took place in 2014, Wills is interviewed, and he is such a honey. He says that Dr. Anderson always looked like a dapper Dan. He said he was a little roly-poly, but he always looked really good.
Okay, underhanded compliment. Backhanded.
Wills really liked him, though. He said something like, he would buy me coffee and sandwiches, and I would buy him coffee and sandwiches. And they would talk about coins and golf.
Wow.
And Wills says, in 2014, he can't talk about him and not smile. So that's the kind of con man Dr. Anderson is.
Okay.
He's like... very likable.
Charm your pants off.
The best kind.
The best kind. So Dr. Anderson only gave Mike two... Oh, this is also from show Imposters. Dr. Anderson only gave Mike 2 days to prepare for his presentation in front of the other doctors at the Children's Hospital. So Mike worked the next 2 days, day and night, putting together charts and informational packets and this whole presentation. So at 8 a.m. on November 26th, 1986... Mike Wills arrived at the Children's Hospital, and Dr. Anderson had arranged to meet Mike privately before he addressed the physicians group. Mike Wills says that elevator doors opened up, and Dr. Anderson was in the elevator. So Mike gets onto the elevator, and they go up, and Wills says there were two other doctors in the elevator, and that Anderson wasn't having conversations with them, but as he got off, he acknowledged them and said, "See you later."
Which is so smart. Because if you're just like, see you later, get off. Nobody can say, I don't fucking know
you. No one's
going
to be like, I'm sorry, before you get off this elevator, who exactly are you?
Yeah, so
unless
smart.
You work at the CIA, you know. So interestingly, though, in the 2014 interview, Will says that he saw Anderson in the hall talking to two other people in lab coats as he walked up, so he assumed that they were doctors, too. So I think it's really fascinating how memory sort of protects you a little bit, and you can renegotiate your memory so that now, of course, you would believe this man because he's talking to two other doctors. Yeah. But it makes way more sense that Anderson had been in that elevator all morning waiting for Wills to show up and get in.
Yeah.
So that makes way more sense. But it's Wills has now sort of changed the story so that it looks like he wasn't as naive.
Totally.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. So anyway, once they got up at the floor, Will said that although there was no one in the halls, it didn't strike him as odd because it was so early in the morning. Dr. Anderson told Mike Wills that he had a safe upstairs where he wanted to store the gold and he would be back momentarily. So basically, Anderson takes Wills into this room. They go through like a private area that the general public can't get into. He takes him into a room. They do the coin stuff and he's like, all right, wait here. I'll be right back. I'm just going to run upstairs to the safe. And Wills sits and waits, and Anderson says he'll be back with a check. So Will says that when he thinks about it, it was probably 5 or 6 minutes, but it felt like an eternity, and his gold was gone. He says he went to a nurse's station and asked a nurse to page Dr. John Anderson. He told the nurse that he just gave him a large amount of gold. The nurse replied that there was no Dr. Anderson at the Children's Hospital. So, in the 2014 interview, Will says that he came out of the room that he was in and a nurse was standing there and she said, "Who are you? You're not supposed to be back here. Can't you read?" And Wills replied, "I'm with Dr. John Anderson." And the nurse said, "There is no Dr. John Anderson here right now." But there was a Dr. John Anderson that had worked there previously.
Whoa,
he just wasn't at the hospital anymore.
Okay.
Wow.
In the 2014 interview, Will says that the room Anderson put him in was a safe room to hide an idiot, and that's where he put me.
Oh,
no.
It's so heartbreaking. And I mean, it, like, you don't have to watch this, obviously, but he is so likable, and he has such a fine attitude about, like, he's just, and I mean, it's been however many years, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, he just is very, like, telling the story as if it he saw it in a movie, as if it didn't happen to him, if he didn't lose 30 grand.
Jesus. You know?
Will said that he felt extremely gullible, that he could be so easily duped out of $30,000. He said he trusted a name tag, and he trusted what the man told him. So Stack says, 3 years later, Dr. Albert Evans, notable for his girth.
I know, I was rude. Rude.
Showed up at a coin shop in Albany, New York. The doctor had made several small purchases from the coin dealer named Wendell Williams. Then Williams received a $45,000 gold coin order from Dr. Evans via Federal Express. Essentially, Dr. Albert Evans had made a series of small purchases from Wendell Williams. Then he calls up Wendell Williams and he says, I want essentially like $80,000 worth of gold. In the interview, he said, I wasn't going to buy that kind of gold, but he wanted to see how Evans would respond when he came in, and Williams essentially told him no, you know? Mm-hmm. So Williams says that on Saturday, November 4th, 1989, when he was waiting on other customers, Evans came in and asked if Williams had his gold, but Williams told him no. So Evans starts asking about Rolex watches, and Williams says, no, I sold that. And then Williams kind of, like, I think feels a little bad that he didn't place the order. So he says, all right, I've got some gold. Like, I've got some gold for you in the back. So he brings him all of the gold that he had in the store. And Evans says he'll take it and he's going to write a check. But Williams says, no, he has to hold the gold until the check clears. Williams said that he told Evans previously, if you want that kind of gold, you got to pay me in cash. Like, there can't be any sort of paper transaction. Mm-hmm. So in the reenactment, Evans is like, oh my God, you know I'm good for it, blah, blah, blah. And he says, I'll write a blank check so that the next time he wants to buy a lot of gold, he doesn't have to wait until it's cleared. Hmm. So then in the reenactment, Evans starts chatting up this customer. Mm-hmm. He, like, introduces himself and starts schmoozing this customer. And Williams goes to help another customer. With Williams distracted, Evans tells the other customer he's speaking to that, I got to get back to the hospital. So he tells him he's going to leave the checks with the customer and asks the man to make sure Williams gets them. So he puts the checks down and then he yoinks the container of coins.
I could not believe.
Mm-hmm. But in the 2014 episode that I watched, Williams is older and wiser, and he tells the story that, yes, Anderson was chatting up a customer, and he makes sure to mention that the customer was a, like, a PhD, like a doctorate, like a very intelligent person. And he's like, he even had him fooled, but he left the check, and this is such a heartbreaker, with a junior employee. So Dr. Evans is standing there talking to this customer who's a very, like, intelligent coin collecting doctorate man or whatever. And then this little kid, right, this teenage boy is across the counter and they're having a conversation. Mm-hmm. So Williams is on the other side of the store. And then what does he say? Oh, Williams says that he saw Anderson's large rear end walking out of the store and he got nervous. So he went to his young employee to make sure Anderson had left cash. The young man said no, but not to worry, because he left a check and another check for next time, too. Ugh. And William said that he looked at the young salesman and said, there ain't going to be a next time, Doc.
Large rear end. So rude.
I know. Well, I mean, I guess he was, like, a pretty big guy, because it keeps coming up.
Yeah.
Like, it keeps coming up. You know, it's very funny. And everything I read, everything I watched, everyone loved him. Like, he would just walk down the street. People loved him. They worshipped him. People in these small towns, like, he was charming and, like, affable. And he would spend a long enough time in these little towns to really create what they thought were relationships.
Yeah. Wow.
And the whole time, he was just biding his time.
Yeah, and they're just charismatic, so you want to believe them.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So Stack says that after that, Dr. Evans skipped town. So FBI Special Agent William Rimfield said that he'll be in town for a couple of months to uncover his scam, and then he'll be disappeared for a couple of months, and they can't seem to figure out what he's been doing for the period of time in between. There are 2 to 5 month gaps between cities, and he could be doing anything from running a legitimate business, pulling another scam somewhere, or just plain vacationing.
Sure.
Just having a vacation on that gold.
Just having it, you know. So authorities have security cam footage of the doctor from a bank in Massachusetts in 1990. So they show those very grainy, ridiculous images. The authorities do not know the man's real name, but they know that in addition to Anderson and Evans, he's also used the aliases Dr. John Miller, Dr. Michael Baker, and Dr. Brown. Not to be confused with Doc Brown from Back to the Future.
I was thinking that too.
Do not confuse.
Do not, okay? Because that Doc Brown is amazing. All right, update. So a viewer tip helped authorities identify Michael John Szabo as the con man. He escaped prison in 1979. Szabo spent time behind bars in 5 states on a variety of convictions, but has since been released. Okay, so here's my update. Have you ever seen the movie Catch Me If You Can?
Yes.
Steven Spielberg's movie? Okay. So that's Frank Abagnale.
Yes.
He's very famous. Apparently that movie was almost about Michael Szabo.
What?
Michael Szabo became notorious in the 1970s and throughout the 1980s for successfully forging bank and government checks, as well as the forgery of stock and bond certificates. Szabo also obtained executive status for certain blue chip companies, made counterfeit payroll checks, scammed numerous major hotel chains, and also obtained gold coins fraudulently. He stole over $10 million throughout the course of his criminal career.
Whoa, so he was high-rolling.
Mm-hmm. The FBI and Interpol have confirmed over 100 false identities that Szabo has used throughout his white-collar crime spree. Szabo impersonated airline pilots with 6 different carriers, medical doctors, PhDs, loan officers, an IRS agent, and once hired 300 people for a 1-day computer scam in Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow.
Just 6 weeks after escaping from a federal prison, he was hired as a deputy sheriff while on the run from the FBI.
What?
The most charming. The most charming
truly.
Man.
Truly.
Szabo's FBI files suggest he was associated with the Lucchese crime family, through which he laundered stolen goods such as diamonds and furs. To make the feature film Catch Me If You Can, director Steven Spielberg petitioned Szabo in the hopes of basing the plot on his life story. However, Szabo could not comply and sell the rights to his story because he was wanted by law enforcement officials across the United States.
Bummer.
Spielberg then opted to use Frank Abagnale as the primary character in the movie.
Wow.
On the lam for 13 years, he posed as a doctor, psychologist, airline pilot, donning pilot's uniforms for TWA, Allegheny, Delta, United, and made his way from state to state conning merchants.
Wow.
While on the run, Szabo had plastic surgery in Florida to the tune of $15,000 on his face.
Damn.
Wow.
At the time, he was using another person's identification, that of a man who was living in a Veterans Administration nursing home in Pennsylvania. He had 8 procedures done on his face,
Jesus.
Including a facelift and implants of cheekbones.
Wow. Oh, my God. In June of 1989,
Szabo passed himself off as Dr. Alfred P. Evans, a psychologist, and opened an account at the then North Star branch at the Empire State Plaza. 4 months later, he deposited 2 worthless checks totaling $53,000 from a bank in Cincinnati. That November, he wrote a check to Sears Computer Center at Colony Center. So the town is Colony that he was actually in. It wasn't Albany. Mm. It's a little town outside of Albany. That November, he wrote a check to the Sears Computer Center at Colony Center for $41,000 for 10 laptops, telling the store clerk that he was doing research for the prison system and had other psychologists interviewing inmates. The bank paid Sears and later learned the checks were worthless.
Oh, my God. I wonder, sorry, just to go back to the plastic surgery for 1 second. I wonder
of if, course you need to. I know.
I wonder if he, like, brought this guy's ID and was like, can you make me look like this?
I don't
know.
Like, hello, if you're a plastic surgeon, that's a red flag.
Also, like, 1980s facial plastic surgery makes me very uncomfortable.
In Florida?
In Florida. Yeah. I mean, now Miami is, like, one of the best places to get work done in the country.
Sure.
But back then, probably not.
Oh, my God.
So in Colony, New York, Szabo gave Fritz Jewelers a check that later bounced for $51,000 for a 4.5-carat diamond ring and took 6 Persian rugs valued at $22,000 from Jaffrey Oriental Rugs Limited, arranging to be billed later. In Albany, Sabo built Ferris Stamp and Coin Shop of 80 maple leaf gold coins, passing a worthless $31,000 check. In one day, he was able to take the local business owners for $150,000. That's almost $325,000 today.
What?
One day.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So Sabo traveled around the country setting up false counseling practices and then used his title and office to gain people's confidence and take their money. He had a nice way about him. He was a likable guy, and shop owners said at the time, he reads like a how-to of sophisticated crime. Quote, "I never used force on anybody," Sabo said. "My personality and non-criminal look helped me get in the door a lot. The only time I ever had a gun in my hand was when I was in the military. I bought suits and I tried to play the role." He drove a 1988 Corvette and had a downtown Albany executive suite. He recalls that the late Albany County Judge John Turner told him that, quote, "the deadliest weapon I ever had in my hand was a pen."
Oh, wow.
During his crime spree in New York, he was living in a suburb of Springfield, Massachusetts. Quote, "it was easy for me to do my little thing and then go on home," he said of Albany County. When he was captured in the motel room in Roanoke, Virginia, federal authorities said that they think Sabo was just passing through Roanoke when he was captured at the Days Inn on Plantation Road. But Marty Sizek, who is the police officer that's interviewed in the segment, says he's not so sure. Quote, "if I know Dr. Evans, Dr. Miller, and Dr. Anderson, he doesn't waste any time. He was probably setting something else up." So up until that point, the UM airing, authorities had been looking for him under the name of Alfred Evans, but a fingerprint on a check passed in the Albany case had matched a print identified as Sabo's. Mm. So Sabo was arrested without incident, and they said that Sabo immediately admitted his identity and said he knew that he was being sought on the fraud charge just in Albany, though, but he was wanted everywhere.
Everywhere.
So like Frank Abagnale, Sabo had his own nemesis. Chasing his tail, always one step behind him, Martin Sizek. So Sabo was one of those guys that cops don't easily forget, and Sizek refers to him as, quote, "the infamous Dr. Evans." Hmm. What was unique about him was that when the case started, it was routine larceny, a diamond theft, but there was something different I just couldn't put my finger on. The detective also knew him as Dr. John Miller and Dr. Brown. Quote, "I stayed with it, and I chased him for 2 years. He sent some checks from Cincinnati, and when I started putting these different cases together, I said, this is the same guy. And that's when we started to hunt."
Hmm.
After receiving complaints from Albany County merchants that they had lost thousands of dollars to a man they trusted and liked, Sizek suspected that this man had been involved in more than just the Albany area con jobs. Rather than working it as a local crime, he drew up a case analysis and submitted it to a national police computer network that existed at the time called Magliclin. The computer system took this case and matched details about the suspect's method of operation against that of other unsolved cases in the database. The system identified 12 similar cases around the country, beginning with one in Asheville, North Carolina in 1987. In each case, a man would set up a practice as a psychologist, complete with an office, a secretary, a telephone answering system, and fictitious diplomas on the wall. In Albany, the, quote, "doctor never saw a patient," Sizek said. And then in the 2014 show that I watched, they interview the man who he stole the Persian rugs from, the expensive rugs. And the man went to the office and the secretary was there and she's boxing up her stuff. And he says, "where's the doctor? He owes me money." And she said, "oh, no, he's not a doctor."
Oh.
And the guy was like, "what?" And she's like, "yeah, no, all of this is fake. He's not a doctor. We don't know who he is." And he was just like, "oh, my God."
Wow.
Wow. So the detective traced the doctor from Asheville to Athens, Georgia, Cincinnati, and Columbia, South Carolina before they came to Albany. And then Sizek said that he found similar cases in California, Nevada, and then back up the East Coast to Massachusetts and Maine. They interviewed Sabo, and I'm just going to read the article.
Mm-hmm.
Sabo talks freely about Martin Sizek. Quote, "Marty, an FBI agent, hunted me down. Because of his escape record, Sabo was sent to New York's Max Correctional Facility, where he met David Berkowitz, the son of
Sam."
quote, I was in Supermax and I was only serving 2 to 6. Most were doing 25 to life. They were all killers. I didn't say too much about my sentence or my background.
Wow. Well, I mean, with his abilities to con and fraud everybody,
he really trusted. And then in 2004 and 2005, Michael Szabo impersonated an IRS agent. So he was sentenced in 2009 for that, for impersonating an IRS agent. And he finished his time in October of 2009. And he settled in Louisville, Kentucky, where he began to sell cars to pay the rent. Quote, I'm trying to get enough exposure, so that I can help people and make for myself a decent living for something I did in the past illegally and turn it around 180 degrees in a positive, legitimate direction.
Very, very Better Call Saul. Very Better Call Saul.
Absolutely. He said that he wanted to educate on identity theft and people like me to stay away from.
Oh my God.
Quote, until everything gets off the ground, I've been selling cars legitimately for the past year. For once in the last 40 years, I'm in a legitimate job using my own name and my own social security number.
Good job, bud. Do you want a cookie?
Wow.
The Social Security Administration has 5 names and date of birth on me when I went down to get a card. They're like, which Michael Szabo are you today? God. Who are you? He says, quote, I work about 60 hours a week. I make enough money. I have my own apartment, my own car, my own insurance, and my own credit cards. In my name, too.
We're all very proud.
I know. In 2010, Szabo opened 2 companies, American Identity Theft Recovery and Identity Theft Watchguard, to help victims of identity theft get their credit and finances back in order and to help protect against identity theft. So I wasn't able to find those companies. And then I found out that at some point, I can't imagine why. And then at some point I found out that Szabo became the founder and executive director of Prison Consultants of America, a consultancy firm for white collar crime. Szabo lectures and consults on identity theft, fraud, etc. But he mainly assists white-collar drugs and sex offenders to, quote, navigate the complex prison system, as he puts it on his website. Mm. Elsewhere on his website, you get the unvarnished truth. Quote, without understanding prison life, you could risk a 25 to 30% chance of getting killed, a 10 to 15% chance of getting raped, a 30 to 40% chance of getting stabbed, and an 80 to 90% chance of getting beaten.
Oh my.
Okay.
What are these statistics?
So then the last thing that I read was Szabo in the interview said, and they're making a documentary about me, which is how I found my way to this amazing imposter series. There's 6 episodes. I'm going to watch them all if they're all as fantastic as this. But yeah, I don't have any recent updates on Szabo. He's been a little radio silent since 2014, but I can only assume that he is living that straight and narrow life, honey.
Of course. Never will he go back.
Never will he go back. He is here to help educate you against people like him. And I love it.
Wow.
I am here for it. So,
I mean, he's using what he knows, right?
I started researching him, and I was like, after the Hardin House, I was like, you've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding me. Just so many legal documents, so many court transcripts, so much stuff. I was like, this can't be happening. How did a stupid fraud segment turn into Catch Me If You Can? Yeah. How did it do
truly.
It? Complete with a nemesis law enforcement guy on his tail the entire time.
Only for you, Allison.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, that is the story of Dr. John Anderson, a.k.a. Michael Szabo. Oh,
nice job.
Congrats on getting through episode 7.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much.
Alive.
It was a trap. The whole episode was a trap.
Absolutely. I was conned.
Truly. He's still conning us.
Szabo, damn you.
Szabo.
If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know that I love to be creeped out. We love our ghosties and our aliens and the paranormal and haunted houses. We're here for all of it. And if you're like me, which you probably are if you're listening to this, you love a ghost story too. And that's why I have a podcast I think y'all will love. It's called Scary Time.
Scary Time is a weekly podcast where an independent creator comes on and tells stories of the paranormal, ghosts, monsters, hauntings, creepy places, enchanted objects, aliens, and more. The best part is, if you like the creator of that episode, you can follow them for more great content. So it's a great way to find new podcasters and new podcasts that you'll love. When I checked out Scary Time, I was so pleasantly surprised to see some creators that I already knew and loved, and I found a bunch more that I didn't even know about. I recently listened to an episode about haunted amusement parks that was created by a guide to the unknown, and it was so good. It was so interesting, and it was really creepy. So this podcast is great because it's a little bit of history, a little bit of locational information, a lot of spooky, scary stuff. It's a lot of fun. You can find Scary Time on any podcast app, so check it out, if you dare. Should we tell our friends about our collective feelsy?
Oh, friends, besides feeling the sweat dripping in all of my crevices, we also have a feelsy and a sharesy that's collective.
Yes.
Let's try and say it at the same time. Okay. Ready?
One, two, three.
Summer vacation. We're taking a break. Okay, you heard it here. That's it. We're going to be gone for a while out of your ear holes.
Getting a month off. Well, we're getting 5 weeks off.
Whew.
Yeah.
Dream.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be back, though, at the end of August. So keep subscribing, please, and join our Patreon if you're going to miss us.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're a patron, we're never going to go away.
No, always going to be in
your ear holes.
You will never.
We've got some summer spooks for you over there, too.
We do. We've got some cryptids. Oh, my
cryptids,
God.
Cryptids.
Spooky Carlin creature, and I went creature. Full cryptid for the summer. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
So we will miss you, but you can still see us on all of our platforms, which I'll mention in a minute. And we're just excited. That's our sharesy feelsy. Allison especially works. We all work very hard, but Allison especially deserves a break from recording, researching, doing the website, and editing the podcast. And I'm sure there are other things I forgot.
And the advertisements, too, and the communication.
Yeah, all the things. All the things. And Carlin with the Instagram and all the things. And so we're excited. And we hope it's not quite this hot where we are in during our break, because it's currently 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And
104 degrees.
Blah, 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 blah. That's disgusting.
Yeah, y'all, 115 in Portland is unheard of. Yeah,
it's terrible.
Thanks, climate change. Global warming.
Okay, so next episode, when we do resume.
Oh, yeah.
We have a little surprise for you upon our return for season 4, episode 8. We're going to have a special little guest for part 1.
How just a little fun. One. It's a very just small
a
person.
A little tiny guest. Mm-hmm. He's actually a very tall person. So that's going to be a fun little surprise.
Are you going to say excited. Who it is?
No.
Oh my gosh.
She's going to leave you hanging, and she doesn't give any fucks about it.
No. That's a 4-week hang you got right there, guys. Too bad. Mm. So sad.
So come back for that. And on that episode, for part 1 of episode 8, season 4, I have an unexplained segment about Sharon Johnson. Oh, and y'all, we got some Pearl Harbor stuff happening.
Oh,
too.
What? Really? Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's weird.
Oh, Pearl Harbor and unexplained. Okay. And then we have an unexplained death of Roger Dean.
And then for part 2, which will come out the following week, I have a fraud segment about Liza Montgomery, and it's a goodie.
Oh, my gosh. And then I have a missing segment, and it's the story of Deborah Poe.
Okay, so like we said, if you think you might miss us the next 5 weeks, go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast and subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher. You'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. You can also still hang out with us on Instagram at resolvemysteriespodcast and on Facebook and Twitter at resolvethepod. And contact us to tell us anything you want to, but especially to send us your stories for listener short stacks so we can keep making those. And you can do that at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005, Portland, Oregon, 97293. Of course, give us a special July gift of subscribing, rating, reviewing, however you can. Help the pod out and tell a friend. And for every review that we receive, we are donating $1 this month to the Epilepsy Foundation.
And 2 out of 3 of us have July birthdays, so it would be an extra special gift if you were to subscribe, rate, review, and tell a friend.
Ooh, a little birthday prezzy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
And we love you so.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Target is Mike Wills, a veteran coin. Oh, fuck. Shit. A veteran coin.
Collector?
I mean, he's a coin
seller. Dealer.
A coin dealer.